Hello, this is Chris Wilhelm, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, October 31st issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our headline today, Older New Yorkers Brace for Food Stamp Cuts. I'm just praying. The SNAP program is losing federal funding on Saturday. Many older people won't be able to easily line up at food pantries or go out and get second jobs. By Anna Cote. Every year around this time, Sandra Bellaro is usually busy starting to prepare for family gatherings as the holiday season begins. I'm Italian, said Ms. Bellaro. We have big families. We usually have beautiful holidays. But this year, she said, we're not having that. Ms. Bellaro, 70, is one of roughly 3 million New Yorkers who rely on food stamps, which will lose federal funding on Saturday amid the government shutdown. Governor Kathy Hochul on Thursday declared a state of emergency because of the looming cutoff and promised more than $100 million in state funding to help fill the gap. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, better known as SNAP or food stamps, provides about $650 million in benefits to New Yorkers each month. More than a fifth of recipients in the state are 60 or older, a group especially vulnerable to harm from the funding halt because they might not be able to pick up jobs for more money or wait in long lines at food pantries. Many may not even be aware of the potential trouble ahead because the state said it would not notify recipients about changes through the mail, which many older people rely on instead of the internet. This week, New York and two dozen states sued the Trump administration over its plan to stop funding SNAP during the shutdown. Ms. Hochul, a Democrat, said New York would use $106 million in state funds for emergency food assistance for food banks and meal programs. Unlike Washington Republicans, I won't sit idly by as families struggle to put food on the table, Ms. Hochul said in a statement. Mayor Eric Adams of New York City also announced that the city would provide $15 million in emergency funding for food pantries and soup kitchens. Ms. Bellaro, a retired healthcare worker who lives in Manhattan, said she receives $292 per month in food stamps, just under the maximum allotment for a single person. Without it, she said she most likely would be limited to meals with eggs, bread, and pasta. SNAP is affecting me in every way, said Ms. Bellaro, who has used food stamps for nearly a decade. I have to see what I have after I pay my bills because that's more important, to keep a roof over my head, than to eat. I could have a cup of coffee. I could have a piece of toast. The amount Ms. Hochul has allocated for emergency assistance is only about 16% of what the state normally receives from the federal government each month, and some experts and advocates believe food pantries are not the right place to send it. Many SNAP recipients are not used to going to food pantries because food stamps can be used at many grocery stores and bodegas and certain restaurants. A lot of people on SNAP don't want to go to food banks, said Emily Eisner, chief economist at the Fiscal Policy Institute. It's sort of stigmatized. You get less choice. It's harder. You have to go out of your routine and figure out where the food bank is. And temperatures are about to drop. If you get to a point where you have nothing, Ms. Bellaro said, you have no other choice but to stand there, freezing, hoping that you get something decent. Roy Ballas, 73, who lives in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, said he might have to go to a food pantry if SNAP is cut, a thought that makes him uneasy. I shouldn't feel embarrassed because there are a lot of people from around the area here that go to this food pantry right around the corner, he said. But you know, you see them waiting on that line and it's so long, now that line is going to be even longer. Mr. Ballas, who has been receiving SNAP for about a decade, said he would be sad if he is no longer able to shop at a local health food store, which to his surprise accepted food stamps. He has been trying to cut down on processed meat and was able to purchase fresh produce from the store, he said. I'm trying to eat more healthy these days, and now this happened, he said. Many New Yorkers are already turning to pantries as inflation made food more expensive. Our pantries are at a breaking point, said Grace C. Bonilla, the president and chief executive of United Way of New York City, a nonprofit that funds more than 400 pantries in the city. With nearly 1.8 million people in New York City on the brink of losing their SNAP benefits, Ms. Bonilla anticipates even longer lines. What we're bracing ourselves for is the impact of having to tell people that we've run out of food at some of these pantries, she said. Older New Yorkers may struggle to adapt, since many have limited access to the internet, advocates say. If someone were to go to a local store and try to buy milk, eggs, and bread, and they can't because their SNAP benefits have ended, they don't know where to go, compared to someone who's younger and might be able to quickly look something up, said Allison Nickerson, the chief executive of the nonprofit Live On, which provides services for seniors. Small and local businesses will also be affected by the cuts. Federal government studies have shown that for every dollar in SNAP benefits that is spent, it produces approximately $1.80 in economic activity in grocery stores, small businesses, and farmers markets, said Stephen Banks, the former commissioner of New York City's Department of Social Services and the former attorney-in-chief of the Legal Aid Society. Ms. Bonilla said losing the money could force many people to make really tough choices in the month of November between rent and transportation and medicine to figure out how they're going to be able to meet their nutritional needs. Mr. Ballas is worried about what the future holds. I just pray on it, he said. I'm just praying because it's going to be rough. Casey Means, Surgeon General nominee, goes into labor ahead of Senate hearing. Dr. Means was set to face questions Thursday from members of a Senate Health Committee. The hearing was postponed by Danny Blum. Dr. Casey Means, the nominee for Surgeon General, was set to face questions Thursday from members of a Senate Health Committee. The hearing was postponed because Dr. Means has gone into labor, a representative for the committee said. The hearing would have been Dr. Means' first high-profile appearance since President Trump nominated her for the role over 5 months ago. If confirmed, she will function as a figurehead for a medical system she has railed against. As the nation's doctor, the Surgeon General has more influence over messaging than policy. The role is largely symbolic, steering the public's attention toward certain health topics by using warnings and reports. But by positioning herself as a disruptive outsider, Dr. Means has already sought to shape the way people think about health. Much of her contempt for the modern medical apparatus, she says, stems from her firsthand experience with what she calls its flaws and fractures. She obtained her medical degree from Stanford, but dropped out of her surgical residency after 4 years, claiming that the conventional healthcare system was failing patients and that she wanted to focus on why people were getting sick in the first place. She has since practiced and promoted functional medicine, which centers on the root causes of disease, and has championed her views on her social media platforms and in a newsletter. But she is perhaps best known for writing a 2024 best-selling book, Good Energy, alongside her brother, Kaylee Means, who has been a close advisor to Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Many of her talking points are also common refrains of Mr. Kennedy's and his Make America Healthy Again movement. Since her nomination, Dr. Means has faced a torrent of criticism from across the political spectrum. Previous surgeon generals have questioned her qualifications and whether someone who is not a practicing physician should hold the role. In the spring, Laura Loomer, the far-right activist with President Trump's ear, derided Dr. Means as a woo-woo woman. But Mr. Kennedy defended her nomination. The attacks that Casey is unqualified because she left the medical system completely miss the point of what we are trying to accomplish with MAHA, he wrote on X in May. Casey is the perfect choice for Surgeon General precisely because she left the traditional medicine system, not in spite of it. Emily Hilliard, a representative for the Department of Health and Human Services, wrote in a statement on Thursday that Dr. Means' credentials, research background, and experience in public life give her the right insights to be the Surgeon General, who helps make sure America never again becomes the sickest nation on earth. In Good Energy, Dr. Means argues that a wide range of chronic diseases are surging in the United States because of our food supply, sedentary and largely indoor lifestyles, environmental toxins, and a medical system that she says prioritizes prescriptions over prevention. One chapter is called Trust Yourself, Not Your Doctor. She contends that American medical care is too siloed, emphasizing narrow specialties over a more holistic approach to health. I deeply respect doctors, but I want to be very clear on something. At every hospital in the United States, many doctors are doing the wrong things, pushing pills and interventions when an ultra-aggressive stance on diet and behavior would do far more for the patient in front of them, the Means siblings wrote in their book. She has suggested that lifestyle changes like eating whole foods, exercising more, and getting more sleep and sunlight could alleviate depression, infertility, diabetes, acne, and a broad swath of health issues. Dr. Means has also argued that Americans take too many medications and pharmaceutical products, and she has criticized current vaccine recommendations. There is growing evidence that the total burden of the current extreme and growing vaccine schedule is causing health declines in vulnerable children, she wrote in an edition of her newsletter. She has called vaccine mandates criminal and has cast doubt on whether all babies need the hepatitis B vaccine at birth, labeling the shot an unnecessary pharmaceutical for many. She has argued that ultra-processed foods are highly addictive and should carry a warning label similar to cigarettes. And she has frequently spoken about a link she sees between personal and environmental health. We are not separate from the earth. We are her. Her illness is our illness, she wrote in her newsletter. She has used her newsletter and broader social media platform to endorse supplements and wellness products. In financial filings released last month, she pledged to step away from promoting these kinds of products. She has also promised to resign her position and sell her stock in Levels, a company she co-founded that provides glucose monitors so that people can track their blood sugar levels, the kind of wearable technology that Mr. Kennedy has said he wants all Americans to use. Mr. Trump initially nominated Dr. Jeanette Nesheiwat, a former Fox News contributor to Surgeon General, before withdrawing her nomination in favor of Dr. Means. Bobby really thought she was great, the president told reporters, referring to Mr. Kennedy when asked why he picked Dr. Means. I don't know her, Mr. Trump said. I listened to the recommendation of Bobby. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Why Trump's boat killings would be hard to prosecute. Even if critics who call President Trump's boat attacks murder are right as a matter of law, it would not be easy to get the matter into a court. By Charlie Savage. A broad range of legal specialists and a growing number of political leaders have called the Trump administration's killing of people at sea, it said were drug runners, illegal and murders. That accusation invites the question of whether anyone involved may someday be held accountable in court. The administration insists that President Trump has the lawful power to order the summary extrajudicial killings, and even if the critics are right, there would be many obstacles to prosecutions. For one, future administrations may not want to allow prosecutions, especially of anyone who was simply following orders, both because of the likely political backlash and to avoid setting a precedent that could inhibit their own actions. But even aside from that practical reality, there would be legal impediments to putting the matter before any court. Here's a closer look. It is illegal for the U.S. military to deliberately target civilians, even those suspected of being criminals, who do not pose a threat of imminent violence. In peacetime, that is murder. In an armed conflict, that is a war crime. This is according to U.S. laws, including the Uniform Code of Military Justice and international law accepted by the U.S. military. Just as the police arrest people they suspect are drug dealers rather than shoot them down in the street, the U.S. Coast Guard, sometimes assisted by the Navy, has long dealt with maritime drug smuggling by intercepting boats and arresting their crews if suspicions of illicit cargo prove accurate. But since September 2nd, on orders from Mr. Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, U.S. Special Operations Forces have been attacking vessels in international waters and killing nearly everyone aboard, blurring the line between enforcing the law and waging a war. Initially, the operation appeared to focus on Venezuelans, but it has increasingly extended to boats carrying Colombians, whose country is a far greater source of narcotics smuggled into the United States. To date, the administration has acknowledged killing 61 people in 14 such strikes. The administration told Congress that Mr. Trump determined that the United States was in a formal armed conflict with drug cartels, and that boat crews suspected of smuggling were combatants. As a rationale for the deadly attacks, the administration says the cartels directly caused the deaths of tens of thousands of American drug users who overdose each year. That policy argument ignores a key fact. Fentanyl, the drug behind a surge in overdoses over the past decade, comes from labs in Mexico. South America instead produces cocaine. In any case, the administration has not offered a legal argument explaining how Mr. Trump could legitimately make his determinations. It has not supplied a theory or analysis to bridge the conceptual gulf between drug trafficking and an armed attack. The Supreme Court last year granted presidents immunity from prosecution for crimes they may commit with their official powers, especially those core to their constitutional duties. Giving orders to the U.S. military as the commander-in-chief of an operation in the name of defending the United States from a foreign threat, even if the orders go too far and are later found unlawful, appears to be the kind of thing for which Mr. Trump is immune. One issue left unclear in Chief Justice John G. Roberts Jr.'s majority opinion in the 2024 immunity case was whether lower-ranking executive branch officials would also be granted immunity for crimes they commit while following a president's orders. The logic of the opinion is that presidents need immunity so they will not be inhibited by fear of future prosecution for how they carry out their constitutional roles. That would arguably extend to subordinates, because presidents must rely on them to carry out their directions in order for anything to happen. Before he leaves office, Mr. Trump could issue sweeping preemptive pardons of anyone who carried out his decisions. Even if he does not, the Trump administration's Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department has issued a memo that apparently blesses the operation as lawful. The administration has not divulged the memo's legal reasoning, so it is not clear whether it contains anything more than what was in the White House notice to Congress. But even if a future administration decides the memo is wrong and rescinds it, the fact that it currently exists would severely inhibit future prosecutions. It would be hard to prove anyone intentionally committed a crime if the Justice Department itself has assured officials that their actions were lawful. It is unlikely that a lawsuit would succeed in this matter. Similar to his shield from prosecution, Mr. Trump has absolute immunity from liability for civil damages arising from any official action taken while president. That comes from a 1982 Supreme Court proceeding involving a lawsuit against former President Richard M. Nixon. Subordinate government officials have only limited immunity from being sued, and that shield does not extend to situations in which they are accused of violating people's constitutional rights, like a wrongful death suit. But the Constitution does not give rights to non-citizens abroad. The legal obstacles to charging Mr. Trump or any subordinates in U.S. court would not protect them from being charged in other countries, raising the theoretical possibility of a prosecution by a nation whose citizens were killed. As a matter of geopolitical reality, it is difficult to imagine a scenario in which the various countries whose citizens have been killed in the U.S. strikes would be in a position to prosecute the current or former leader of a superpower that dominates the Western Hemisphere militarily and economically. The International Criminal Court in The Hague, Netherlands, has its own obstacles. The court was established in 2002 to prosecute crimes against humanity, genocide, and war crimes. Its definition of crimes against humanity includes murders that are part of a deliberate, widespread, or systemic attack directed against any civilian population. The court has issued arrest warrants for President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia for alleged war crimes in Ukraine and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel for alleged crimes against humanity and war crimes in Gaza. It is prosecuting Rodrigo Duterte, the former president of the Philippines, for his brutal crackdown on drug dealers, which included extrajudicial killings. Mr. Trump praised Mr. Duterte in 2017 for his approach. But for now, the International Criminal Court does not appear to have clear jurisdiction over the boat attacks. The multilateral treaty that created the court allows it to bring cases if the accused are citizens of a country that is a party to that treaty, or if offenses took place in the territory of a party or aboard a vessel or aircraft flagged to one. But the United States has not joined the treaty. The strikes have also apparently taken place in international waters, and there has been no sign that the small boats were registered. Mr. Trump has publicly mused about ordering U.S. military to target people suspected of drug cartel involvement who are on land. Doing so could give the court clear hypothetical jurisdiction over officials or troops involved in such killings. Notably, Venezuela is a party to the International Criminal Court's treaty, but there would be other major problems. The United States, under the presidents of both parties, has strongly resisted accepting that the court can legitimately investigate American political leaders or troops, and Congress has enacted laws requiring the government to shun the institution, including making it illegal to extradite Americans to the court's custody. Trump and Xi ease off the trade war, but new nuclear threat brings a chill. The two leaders reached an agreement on fentanyl, some tariffs, and rare earths, at least for a year. But even as the global trade picture cleared a little, Mr. Trump spurred new worries about nuclear proliferation. By Katie Rogers and Erica L. Green. Ahead of the high-stakes meeting between President Trump and Xi Jinping of China on Thursday, world leaders were hoping for news of an economic truce that could help stabilize the global economy. They got it. They got something extra as well, intensified concerns about whether the world is entering a new era of nuclear weapons proliferation among global powers. After a 90-minute face-to-face meeting in South Korea, Mr. Trump announced that the two leaders had sharply de-escalated their trade standoff, agreeing, in essence, on a year-long ceasefire that would roll back tit-for-tat measures, including steep tariffs and shutting off access to rare earth metals. The meeting was the most anticipated and consequential event of Mr. Trump's nearly week-long tour through Asia, where he engaged in a series of trade and security agreements with other countries in the region, many of them geared toward containing Beijing. I guess on the scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being the best, I would say the meeting was a 12, Mr. Trump said aboard Air Force One as he returned to Washington. The agreement was a win for the world economy, but was brokered under the shadow of a new and sudden amplification of nuclear threats between global powers. Just minutes before he landed in Busan, South Korea, to meet with Mr. Xi, Mr. Trump announced on social media that the United States would immediately restart nuclear weapons testing after a lull of more than 30 years. The announcement came after Russia announced that it had conducted tests of a nuclear-capable missile and sea drone this week. Because of other countries' testing programs, I have instructed the Department of War to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis, he wrote, saying the process would begin immediately. Mr. Trump did not provide any further details about the decision, but with his message, Mr. Trump seemed to be ratcheting up pressure as he prepared to meet with the leader of the world's second-largest economy and third-largest nuclear arsenal. After the meeting, Mr. Trump praised Mr. Xi as a great leader of a very powerful, very strong country, and he appeared to soften his hard-edged statement from earlier in the day, suggesting that his announcement was not aimed at China, but at other nations that he repeatedly declined to name. "We have more nuclear weapons than anybody. We don't do testing," Mr. Trump said. "We've halted it for years, many years ago," he said. "But with others doing testing, I think it's appropriate that we do also." But the chaotic backdrop to the meeting was a reminder of how Mr. Trump's approach to issues and diplomacy can change on a dime, even on a matter as vital as the strategy governing the American nuclear arsenal, and also displayed his increasingly volatile approach to foreign policy since he retook office. The meeting also drove home how much is at stake every time the United States and China meet now: the global economy, security across the world, and the sprawling implications of negotiation between the two countries affecting everything from individual alliances in the Indo-Pacific to the outcome of the Russian invasion in Ukraine. A readout issued by the Chinese official news agency Xinhua after the meeting did not address what agreements were made, but did allude to China's recent move to cut off supplies of critical minerals. The statement noted that Mr. Xi told Trump that recent twists and turns in the U.S.-China relationship should be a lesson to them both to avoid the vicious cycle of mutual retaliation. The meeting concluded with clear victories for Mr. Trump's foreign and domestic agenda. Mr. Trump told reporters on Air Force One that China had agreed to suspend for a year its limits on exports of rare earth metals, which are crucial for a wide range of advanced manufacturing industries. The move by China earlier this month to restrict the exports had prompted Mr. Trump to threaten to cancel this week's meeting. He also said that Mr. Xi had agreed to take stronger action to stop the flow of precursor chemicals for making fentanyl, and that the United States, in response, would reduce to 10% from 20% the fentanyl-linked tariffs it had imposed on China early this year. Reducing fentanyl deaths in the United States has been a priority for Mr. Trump. In a social media post, Mr. Trump said that Mr. Xi had also committed to purchasing a massive amount of soybeans and other agricultural products, adding that our farmers will be very happy. He wrote that China would also begin the process of purchasing American energy. While Mr. Trump greeted Mr. Xi warmly ahead of their talks at a military base in Busan, the mood was more fraught than it had been when he met the leaders of Japan and South Korea earlier this week. For Mr. Trump, his 5 days in Asia beforehand had largely been about gathering honors and securing trade deals quickly. On Thursday, the tour took a sober turn as he encountered Mr. Xi, even as he called him a friend of mine. Before meeting, the two leaders tensely shook hands in front of a row of Chinese and American flags at an airbase in Busan, with Mr. Trump doing the talking and Mr. Xi staying largely silent. President Xi is a great leader of a great country, and I think we're going to have a fantastic relationship for a long period of time, Mr. Trump said. Mr. Xi, for his part, approached the meeting with caution and steeliness. In his remarks, Mr. Xi likened U.S.-China relations to a giant ship that requires steady joint leadership. Mr. Xi also said that he and Mr. Trump do not always see eye to eye with each other, and said it was normal for the two leading economies of the world to have frictions now and then. He also suggested that he would not bend to Mr. Trump's America First agenda. "I always believe that China's development goes hand in hand with your vision to make America great again," Mr. Xi said. Before their private meeting, the two leaders said they were focused on a long list of trade negotiations before them and signaled they would ignore far graver concerns, including the resumption of nuclear testing among hotly competing countries and Mr. Xi's interest in putting more distance between America and Taiwan. Mr. Xi did not respond to a question about whether he would raise the issue of Taiwan at the meeting. Mr. Trump did not answer a question about why he had ordered nuclear weapons testing to resume for the first time in 33 years. The president paused before declining to answer the question, a rare reaction for an almost always spontaneous leader. Mr. Trump said after the meeting that the issue of Taiwan did not come up during the leader's discussion. On Wednesday, Mr. Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One that he did not expect it to, and he would not say whether or not he supported independence for the self-governed island, which China claims as its own. The two leaders discussed partnering to address other conflicts, he said. Mr. Trump said that he and Mr. Xi had discussed the war in Ukraine at length, and that they were going to work together to see if we can get something done. Mr. Trump, who has pressured other nations to stop purchasing Russian oil, which is helping to fund its invasion of Ukraine, noted that Mr. Xi had been buying oil from Russia for a long time, but said they did not really discuss the topic. Mr. Trump added that the United States was already in talks with Russia about denuclearization and that China would be added to that. Mr. Trump's announcement also came after he had made substantial announcements about building the defenses of American allies in the region. At a naval base near Tokyo on Tuesday, Mr. Trump said that the Japanese government had placed an order of American-made missiles to arm their fighter jets. His administration has been pressuring the Japanese to spend more on military defense. Standing next to him, Prime Minister Sane Takaichi of Japan promised that she had renewed her resolve to make the Indo-Pacific free and open, a reference to checking Chinese maneuvers and territorial ambitions in the South China Sea. In South Korea, Mr. Trump highlighted the country's investment in American shipbuilding and said later that he had given the U.S. ally approval to build a nuclear-powered submarine. By the time he arrived in Busan, Mr. Trump was hoping that he had collected enough leverage for an agreement with Mr. Xi and was looking for more chances to engage. Throughout his trip, Mr. Trump struck a hopeful tone about striking a deal that could bolster a fragile trade truce that the United States and China struck last month after four rounds of negotiations. As he flew back to Washington, Mr. Trump declared victory. He called the meeting a great success and announced that he would visit in China in April. "The whole relationship is very, very important," he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Prince Andrew to be stripped of his royal title. The extraordinary move caps his fall from grace over his ties to the convicted sexual predator, Jeffrey Epstein. By Mark Landler. Andrew, the scandal-scarred younger brother of King Charles III, will be stripped of his title as prince, an extraordinary punishment, unheard of in the annals of the modern British royal family, that caps his fall from grace over his ties to the convicted sexual predator, Jeffrey Epstein. In a statement on Thursday, Buckingham Palace said it had begun a formal process to remove the style, titles, and honors of Prince Andrew. The prince, it said, will now be known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the family name of members of the House of Windsor. The palace also said that Andrew, 65, would be evicted from his sprawling residence, Royal Lodge, and moved to a private house. The announcement in a terse three-paragraph statement came after Britain's royal family was plunged into a widening crisis over new disclosures about the extent of Andrew's links to Mr. Epstein and more damning details about his alleged sexual abuse of a young woman trafficked to him by Mr. Epstein. Andrew has steadfastly denied that he raped the woman, Virginia Roberts Giuffre, but doubts about his account of his relationship with Epstein, as well as sordid details of his sexual misconduct in a newly published memoir by Ms. Giuffre, made his position in the royal family increasingly untenable. Ms. Giuffre died by suicide in Australia last April. Mr. Epstein died also by suicide in 2019 while awaiting trial on federal sex trafficking charges. Some British lawmakers had called on Parliament to take action against Andrew or to pass legislation that would make it easier for the King to do so. The government has resisted getting involved, reflecting an ancient custom of the Crown and Parliament staying out of each other's business. But the drumbeat of disclosures was making it harder to avoid taking more definitive action against Andrew. Last week, Andrew announced he would give up the use of his other most prominent title, the Duke of York. His status as a prince, the palace said at the time, was based on his being the son of a monarch, Queen Elizabeth II. On Thursday, palace officials said the king was sending royal warrants to the Lord Chancellor, requesting that he remove both the titles of Duke of York and Prince, as well as the honorific His Royal Highness, from the peerage roll, which sets out royal and aristocratic titles in Britain. The palace said this would not require an act of Parliament, as some legal experts speculated last week. Charles, palace officials said, was pushing the boundaries of his royal prerogative because he did not want Parliament to spend time on this matter at the expense of other pressing national issues. Not since King Edward VIII abdicated the throne in 1936 over his proposed marriage to a divorced American woman, Wallis Simpson, has the royal family experienced such an abrupt and visible downgrade of one of its most senior members. When Prince Harry and his American-born wife Meghan announced in 2020 that they would withdraw from official duties and move to the United States, he remained a prince, and the couple remained the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, titles bestowed on them by the Queen when they married. Palace officials also said that Andrew would move to a residence on the grounds of Sandringham, a royal residence in Norfolk, northeast of London, which is owned personally by Charles. The king, they said, would support Andrew through his private funds. Andrew's former wife, Sarah Ferguson, who had lived with him at Royal Lodge, will receive no further support from the family, officials said. These censures are deemed necessary, notwithstanding the fact that he continues to deny the allegations against him, the palace said in a statement. Their Majesties wish to make clear that their thoughts and utmost sympathies have been and will remain with the victims and survivors of any and all forms of abuse. For all the censure, officials said Andrew did not lose his place in the line of succession to the throne. He is eighth. But they noted that just as in the case of Edward VIII, Britain would never allow an unsuitable person to become sovereign. Andrew's daughters, Princess Beatrice and Princess Eugenie, will keep their titles. Palace officials said the decision to act against Andrew had been made by Charles himself in response to what he viewed as serious lapses of judgment on his brother's part. They said the king was supported by other members of the family, including Prince William, his elder son, and the heir to the throne. Experts on the royal family said Charles was acting partly out of fear that the relentless scandal over Andrew was sapping public support for the monarchy. In 2023, a poll of British social attitudes by the National Center for Social Research found that 54% of people surveyed said it was very or quite important for Britain to have a monarchy, compared with 86% in 1983. Andrew's ties to Mr. Epstein have haunted him for more than a decade, costing him his job as a trade ambassador for Britain. But his problems deepened in 2019 after he gave a calamitous interview to the BBC. In it, he denied having sex with Miss Giffray and insisted that he had cut off contact with Mr. Epstein in 2010. British newspapers recently reported that Andrew sent a supportive email to Mr. Epstein a year later. The fierce public backlash over the BBC interview led Andrew to withdraw from official duties in 2019, but his problems kept mounting. After a judge allowed a lawsuit filed by Miss Giffray against Andrew to go ahead in 2022, he lost his honorary military titles and use of the honorific His Royal Highness. Andrew settled the suit with Miss Giffray later that year without admitting wrongdoing, and his mother helped fund the undisclosed payment. But after the Queen died in September 2022, his position became more isolated. The surrender of his lease to Royal Lodge became one of the last sticking points in sealing his estrangement. When the palace stripped Andrew of the use of the title Duke of York this month, officials said he would no longer be invited to the family's Christmas celebration, traditionally held at Sandringham. Now he will live in internal exile, bearing the title of a commoner, in a house on the grounds of the castle where the rest of his family gathers. Not so bulletproof. A far-right party faces rebuke in the Netherlands. Geert Wilders suffered a loss of support as a center-left party staged major gains, an election result that could offer lessons for Europe's far-right. By Gina Smialek, Claire Moses, and Koba Rijkewert. Dutch voters rebuked a far-right party in Wednesday's national elections after it had caused months of a political upheaval, and they unexpectedly threw support to a center-left party that ran on promises of stability and hope. That sudden reorientation is likely to usher in a more centrist government in the Netherlands, which says something about the state of not only Dutch politics, but of populism in Europe more broadly. It shows that the far-right, even in a place that had once seemed to be in an inexorable march toward greater power, is capable of hitting a roadblock. We thought it was almost a deterministic thing, that the radical right was always going to become bigger, that they were bulletproof, said Christoph Jacobs, a political scientist at Radboud University, which sits near the German border. Not so bulletproof after all. On Thursday, official counts showed that Geert Wilders' far-right Party for Freedom, which had swept into power in 2023, had lost 11 seats in the Dutch House of Representatives. It was projected to tie with the center-left party Democrats, 66, or D66, to be the largest group in the legislature. That vote amounted to a rebuke of Mr. Wilders' party, which in 2023 had captured the largest share of seats by a wide margin. Mr. Wilders, a populist firebrand with strident anti-Islam views, had himself spurred this election. In June, he pulled his party out of a governing coalition, plunging the government into chaos and necessitating the snap vote. In its time in power, Mr. Wilders' party had failed to enact its bold calls for slashing asylum and gutting climate regulation, or to get much done at all. And so Mr. Jacobs said, the election suggested that far-right groups that fail to deliver on their promises can be punished for that failure. It had once seemed like nothing stuck to them, he added, because voters focused on their rhetoric. Given how many spots Mr. Wilders' party lost and how many the center-left party gained in Wednesday's vote, the next governing coalition is now expected to be dominated by more moderate politicians. Voters did not ditch the far right entirely. Not only was Party for Freedom projected to tie for the most seats, according to the official count reported by the Dutch newswire ANP, but smaller, similarly oriented parties picked up many of the seats that it had lost. Dutch politics in recent years has offered a window into one of the biggest political trends sweeping the continent, given the popularity of Party for Freedom. Populist far-right parties have become entrenched across the continent, with France's National Rally, Alternative for Germany, and Britain's Reform UK all topping polls. Yet they have faced mixed results at achieving power. Germany's far-right party is shut out of governing. Spain's Vox has been climbing in popularity, but it remains far from dominant. The right in Britain has surged and ebbed, and now seems to be on the rise again. For Europe, the Dutch election may show that caustic comments alone are not enough to keep voters. Mr. Wilders' party was the force behind an often dysfunctional coalition that it ultimately blew up. "I think the Netherlands is a bit fed up," said René Hendricks, a volunteer at a voting location in The Hague. Democrats 66, named for the year the party was founded, ran on a platform that read like a rebuttal to far-right ideas. The party's slogan, "It Can Be Done," which scores of supporters chanted at a victory party on Wednesday night, had strong echoes of Barack Obama's 2008 slogan, "Yes, We Can." The leader of D66, Rob Jetten, ran a campaign of relentless optimism. "It was the opposite of Mr. Wilders' doom and gloom," said Mr. Jacobs, the political scientist. D66 promised to build 10 new cities to try to solve the country's persistent housing shortage, which had been foremost on voters' minds. The party emphasized green energy and embraced artificial intelligence. And while it said that migrants who committed crimes should be removed from the country, D66 argued that what was needed were well-thought-out and effective policies, rather than using strong language. Instead of Mr. Wilders, who is 62 and a longtime figure in Dutch politics, D66 is headed by the younger, less seasoned Mr. Jetten. A 38-year-old who became party leader in 2023, Mr. Jetten could become the country's first openly gay prime minister. "Part of the explanation is that they've had a good campaign," said Sarah DeLong, a political scientist at Leiden University, noting that Mr. Jetten had performed well in televised debates. D66 was also seen by many as a potential ticket to a sustainable coalition. "A very important issue for some voters is regaining stability," she said. For many people, Mr. Wilders seemed to embody the opposite. A political provocateur known for his anti-Islam and anti-Europe stances, Mr. Wilders has long touted extreme positions, arguing for ending immigration from Muslim countries as well as completely halting asylum. When Mr. Wilders' party entered the government, getting such policies through a coalition comprised mainly of more moderate right-wing parties proved difficult. Mr. Wilders did not become prime minister because he lacked support from his fellow lawmakers. Then, this summer, he withdrew his party from the governing coalition because it would not push through his extreme migration plan, which caused the government to implode after less than a year. He then campaigned on those very ideas. Having found that governing alongside Mr. Wilders' party was all but impossible, leaders from other big parties isolated it, saying before Wednesday's vote that they would refuse to form a new coalition with Party for Freedom. That may have pushed people to vote for parties that would have a bigger chance at actually ending up in government, experts said. While Wednesday's election result was a clear slip for Party for Freedom, it was far from a funeral knell for Dutch populism. Not only was Mr. Wilders' party projected to remain tied as the largest, but another far-right party, JA21, gained seats in the House of Representatives. And parties to the left ceded ground as voters moved toward the center. "It's not like we were wiped off the map," Mr. Wilders said. That may make the lesson for the rest of Europe nuanced. Far-right populism is capable of faltering, but that does not mean it is going away. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Volkswagen, hit by tariffs, reports $1.5 billion loss and warns of chip shortage. By Melissa Eddy. Volkswagen said on Thursday that it lost $1.5 billion in the third quarter because of President Trump's tariffs and the company's shift away from electric vehicles at Porsche, but that it remained on track to meet its financial targets for the year, provided it can secure the semiconductors it needed to power its vehicles. The Volkswagen Group, which includes Audi, Volkswagen, and Porsche among its 10 brands, has been ensnared in the standoff between the United States and China over Nexperia, a Dutch company that makes basic microchips that Volkswagen and other European automakers depend on for systems like windshield wipers, blinkers, and warning lights. Failure to resolve the dispute could inflict further losses on Volkswagen at a time of falling demand in China and rising U.S. tariffs, which have jumped to 15% from 2.5% in August. For decades, Germany relied on its booming auto industry to provide jobs and generate revenue that helped earn it the moniker of the engine of Europe. But figures posted by the German Statistical Office on Thursday made clear that the troubles extended beyond the automakers, as the German economy in July to September failed to grow from the previous 3 months. Analysts warned that the crisis raised by the dispute over Nexperia reflected an overall downgrading of the once powerful industry. Current fears of production stops in the German automotive industry as a result of Chinese export controls on microchips are one of too many reminders that German industry is no longer dictating the rules of the game, and instead merely lies at the receiving end, Karsten Breske, an economist at ING Bank, wrote in a note. Last month, the Dutch government moved to take control of Nexperia, which is based in the Netherlands but owned by a Chinese company, WingTech. In response, Beijing halted all exports of Nexperia's chips, more than half of which are assembled in China. Volkswagen is scrambling week by week to secure enough of the roughly 2,000 small semiconductors it needs, Arno Antlitz, the company's chief financial officer, said in a call with analysts on Thursday. "We are safe until the end of next week," he said. But the situation remains precarious. The forecast is based on the assumption that there will be sufficient availability of semiconductors, the company said in a statement. Volkswagen's loss of 1.3 billion euros from a profit of 2.8 billion euros a year earlier was the first the company posted since pandemic lockdowns, which disrupted global supply chains and caused semiconductor shortages. Overall, Volkswagen expects that total costs related to tariffs will amount to $5 billion this year. Looking ahead, the automaker is trying to find other ways to cut costs to counter the impact of the trade war. "We expect tariffs to stay," Mr. Antlitz said. "To mitigate their effect, we need to step up efforts to reduce costs and increase productivity in all brands and units." Volkswagen has been in talks with the Trump administration about ways to take into account the company's investments in the United States, including $1 billion in the electric vehicle manufacturer Rivian. The company also said it would decide by the end of the year whether to build a plant in the United States for its Audi unit. A shift away from an all-electric strategy at Porsche cost Volkswagen 4.7 billion euros in charges during the first 9 months of the year. Porsche has seen demand for its luxury sports cars plunge, especially in China. Last week, the division, which is 75% owned by Volkswagen, posted an operating loss in the quarter of 966 million euros, compared with a profit of 974 million euros a year earlier. Porsche is cutting nearly 4,000 jobs this year, with more losses expected at the end of the year as it returns to making combustion engines. Oliver Blume, who has worn the double hat of chief executive at Volkswagen and Porsche since September 2022, is expected to step down at the end of this year. An old-fashioned Halloween store that won't give up the ghost. Halloween Adventure, a fixture in Lower Manhattan, has long prided itself on being a place where customers and employees can express themselves. By Kasia Andrik. Even in 1997, when Halloween Adventure first opened in the East Village of Manhattan, it was already a throwback. When online shopping was first growing, the expansive store nonetheless embraced an old-fashioned treasure hunt experience. These days, it even prints bright orange maps of its overflowing aisles for shoppers. Halloween Adventure is a mom-and-pop business dedicated to a single holiday all year. Beyond Halloween, the store attracts cosplayers, theater kids, horror movie and science fiction fans, goth and emo devotees, and just about anyone who is serious about playing dress-up. For a store that is out of step with the times, and maybe because it is, Halloween Adventure has earned a devoted following among customers and loyalty from employees. Much of that can be credited to the contagious enthusiasm of one of the owners, Anthony Bianchi of Red Bank, New Jersey, who always dresses in black with his long silver hair in a ponytail. Halloween is a party. New York is Halloween all year round, Mr. Bianchi, 80, said. But with every passing year, it becomes harder to keep the doors open, Mr. Bianchi said. E-commerce takes a bigger and bigger bite of sales. The economic turmoil of the pandemic almost shut the place down, and every autumn, the country's largest retailer of Halloween-themed products, Spirit Halloween, blankets the city with dozens of pop-up stores. Halloween Adventure does have a website, but it doesn't sell costumes online. It's just not how it does business, Mr. Bianchi said. The internet is so impersonal, he said. We're still touchy-feely. Mr. Bianchi still resists changing much about Halloween Adventure. Like a favorite cafe, bar, or bookstore, it's a place where you while away time. But for some, it becomes a backdrop for friendships that feel like family and a setting for only in New York tales. I genuinely feel like I have a home here. I fit in. I belong here, Maya Pons, a 24-year-old store salesperson, said. I love that you can be and do whatever you want without judgment, they added. The operation is sprawling, with entrances on both sides of a city block. There are over 30 sections based on costume genres, including specific movies like Harry Potter and The Wizard of Oz, and longtime favorites like clown, nurse, cop, mixed in with their sexy variants. Mr. Bianchi, who was an art student in the 1960s, arrived at his love for costumes and masks as a passionate fan of science fiction, especially Star Wars. Around the early 1990s, Mr. Bianchi met Bruce Goldman, a former toy store owner who was exploring the costume business at a Halloween trade fair. Halloween Adventure was born. Memorable years followed. There was the time a snowstorm struck on Halloween. One night, Alice Cooper, the theatrical rock musician, came rushing through the front door looking for 8 gallons of fake blood. Red or black? A staff member recalled asking in response. On separate occasions, Keanu Reeves and Whoopi Goldberg strolled in. Members of Saturday Night Live sometimes dig through the aisles in search of a prop or costume. Weird Al Yankovic was literally just here, Isis Torres, a senior makeup artist, said this week. Ms. Torres, 42, said the store could help just about anyone transform themselves through makeup and costumes. A lot of the celebrities, film students, productions, they come through here. Many members of the staff arrive at Halloween Adventure with a love of costumes and makeup, along with niche, some would say eccentric, interests. Taylor Stevens, 36, a salesperson, was a singer in a pirate sea shanty based on Long Island. Mav Beer, a 28-year-old cashier, previously performed in a haunted house on Staten Island. Ms. Torres crafts her own fang veneers and wears a different pair of colored contacts every day. Mr. Stevens said it was fun to work at Halloween Adventure, especially if you're someone who is not necessarily considered what they would call part of the norms. Alternative folk, people who enjoy the fun, spooky side. There are about 20 full-time staff members, with dozens more seasonal workers. Most people are paid minimum wage, and working in retail can bring headaches. Grayson Ohana, a 33-year-old security guard, said he had dealt with shoplifters and vagrants. Christian Hammond, 27, a salesperson, said some customers were difficult. Like any other retail job, you're going to meet customers who are very rude and disrespectful, Mr. Hammond said. At least when you come in here, you get to have fun in your element as well. Many customers appreciate that shopping at Halloween Adventure can be an experience more than an errand. Darla Stachecki, 53, who works in real estate, arrived on a recent evening with her 9-year-old Shih Tzu, Coco. She was planning a costume for her dog based on Carrie, the Stephen King character who goes on a rampage after being doused in pig's blood at prom. Ms. Stachecki first ordered some items from Amazon, but wasn't satisfied, she said. She decided to visit Halloween Adventure. I live in this neighborhood. They have everything here, so honestly, I know to come here, she said. They have the weirdest things you will not find anywhere else. Orlando Silva, 31, who lives in Brooklyn, works for the United States Postal Service, said he likes to be outfitted at the store for Renaissance fairs. "I do know it was going to close a couple years back, and we were pretty upset about that," Mr. Silva said. "I'm glad it's still around. I'd like to come here more." For Halloween Adventure's busiest days, Mr. Bianchi has a tradition. He wears a pirate's cape, a black floppy hat to which he has glued plastic eyeballs, bugs, and bones over the years, and a tattered Batman shirt the staff has often patched up for him. "You're always a geek if you run a Halloween store," Mr. Bianchi said on several occasions, shrugging at the ridiculousness of his look. On the first day this year that he brought out his outfit, several staff members shouted, "Tony means business." Although Mr. Bianchi lives in New Jersey, he has temporarily moved to New York City for the busy final days of Halloween season. Whether he is in his office or slashing open boxes of products with his spiky silver rings, he is often stressed by how many products sell out before Halloween, including cattails and plastic pitchforks. "Mr. Bianchi demands as much from himself as he does from the staff," Ms. Torres said. "He's a very busy man," she said, "but he is also a caring boss," she added. "He's more like an uncle to me, the big uncle you never thought you'd have, as far as making sure I keep up with my health and that I get proper rest so I'm in full function for every shift," she said. Passing through the aisles on a recent afternoon, Mr. Bianchi waved hello to little children shopping. "He has spread his love of Halloween to his 5 grandchildren," he said. His sense of family extends to longtime staff members. He briefly retired during the pandemic, but came back a few years later as a co-owner because he just couldn't let go. "At 80 years old, it's like I've got an old habit," he said. He said he wanted Halloween Adventure to remain a place where up-and-coming generations could wander in to try on a Darth Vader mask or anything else to help them escape into their imagination. "When you come in here, it's fun," he said, "even when life is tough. How can you walk in and not smile?" Through the years, ownership of Halloween Adventure has switched multiple times as the place has struggled, and both Mr. Goldman and Mr. Bianchi have stepped away at points. Halloween Adventure was part of a modest franchise, but its handful of satellite stores around the country have closed. "Revenue is not what it used to be," Mr. Bianchi said, declining to give specific figures. Nightclubs, which help drive Halloween sales, have been closing. Online costume shopping offers lower prices and sometimes free shipping. In the store's early days, you could print money on Halloween because there was no real competition, he said. "The business may even have to start selling online," he said, "whatever it takes to keep the doors open." Last week, Etienne Kotz, 17, was visiting New York from Israel with his father, Barak, when they walked by Halloween Adventure and decided to enter. Etienne bought a green-haired clown mask for himself and a horned devil one for his brother. "Yes, it costs a lot, $70, he said, but he said it's worth it. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 31st issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chris Wilhelm. Thank you for listening, and happy Halloween.